really delighted to introduce Professor Zini Magabane. You're looking behind her at a picture of Nelson Mandela leaving 10 Downing Street after a meeting with the Prime Minister in London in 2007. Professor Magabane is an associate professor of sociology here at Boston College, where she also holds an appointment in the African and African Diaspora Studies program. She specializes in social theory and the sociology of race, ethnicity, and African societies. She's the author of many scholarly articles and several books, including Bringing the Empire Home, Race, Class, and Gender from University of Chicago Press. Professor Magabane earned her PhD and Master's in Sociology from Harvard University and her BA in Politics from Princeton. A South African native, she also worked in the country as a research associate for the Human Sciences Research Council in Pretoria and as a guest lecturer at the University of Cape Town, where many of you in this room have spent some time as well. Last semester, on December 5th, 2013, the Boisy Center hosted a preview screening of the feature film Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, based on Madiba's autobiography at the Coolidge Corner Theater. We invited Professor Magabane and Professor Sean Copeland from Theology to give a post-film sort of analysis. And as it happened, in a remarkable and sad coincidence, that was the very day that Nelson Mandela passed away. And so that film and that conversation took on a different, more weighty sort of emphasis. And yet we had such a short time to talk afterward before they kicked us out of the theater to make room for the next screening, that we just knew that we had to have her back to continue this conversation about South Africa after Nelson Mandela. And we're just so delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for the nice welcome, and it's so nice to see so many people going to Cape Town. I'm actually also going to be a visiting lecturer in Cape Town in the spring of 2015, so I feel like I'm just taking all of BC with me, and I will certainly be seeing some of you. So, but it's very great to have so many people thinking of South Africa as such a inviting destination, because in certainly my recent memory is in 1985, growing up as a kid, my parents were very strong in the anti-apartheid movement. Nobody wanted to go to South Africa. You were told it was full of terrorists and dangerous people and it was going to go collapse into civil war. So I do think in just even speaking about the legacy of Mandela and South Africa, you know, 20 years after independence, it is important to note that we may take it for granted that it is a favorite destination for people doing aid work, for people going to study, for people to go on vacation. And that was by no means a foregone conclusion as the anti-apartheid struggle was being waged. So today, I mean, I want to talk about a couple of different things, especially about maybe more of the contemporary challenges, but keeping in mind the fact that we mustn't take it for granted that there is even the political space for South Africa to be having some of the challenges that it's having without having degenerated or even being on the brink of degenerating to anything like an ethnic war or a civil war and so forth. But I would like to say that, especially speaking in a center devoted to religion and American public life, I would say that in South Africa, what is really the pressing issue of the near future, and really the pressing issue for South Africa and Africa in general, is this question of the relationship between sexuality, sexual equality, gender equality, religion, traditional culture, and public life. So when I actually happened to be in South Africa during spring break, and I went and I was asked to give an address at this foundation established by the former president, Thabo Mbeki. Much like there, once you retire from the presidency, you know, you get a library. Well, you don't get a library, but you will at least get a center. And my mandate was to sort of speak about what were the coming challenges for gender and African women's thought leadership was, I believe, my topic. And I feel that the two, so it really got me thinking and looking at what is happening with gender politics on the continent right now. And I do feel that it is really a center of, or you might say ideological center around which many issues that dovetail with human rights, freedom, traditional culture are all coming together. And I do feel that it is both the potential for the African continent and South Africa to take a unique leadership role, but also at the same time, it may be also a place for the undoing of a lot of the democratic gains that have been made in South Africa and other places. So let me explain perhaps further. So while I was in South Africa, everyone was riveted by their version of the O.J. Simpson trial, which is Oscar Pistorius, you may know him, Blade Runner. He is currently on trial for he definitely killed his girlfriend. The question is, did he intentionally murder her, or was it an act of self-defense? And what was interestingly is they noted that what is on trial, equally as much as Oscar, is it a plausible thing that South Africa is such a dangerous place and that there is such a menace of a black threat that you could be so frightened that you would forget about if someone was sleeping next to you in bed, be moved rather if someone was in the bathroom, instead of simply fleeing to instead need to pump bullets into that bathroom and so on and so forth. So the other thing that is on trial, of course, is the notion of what are the rights of patriarchy. So what has been noted is the fact that what is also on trial is the fact that in South Africa, it has become quite permissible to enact somewhat extreme forms of gender-based violence. And why it is why the Pistorius' case is so interesting is that for the first time it is bringing to light the extent to which this problem of gender violence is a problem that goes across racial and ethnic groups. So generally the picture of gender violence in South Africa is the picture of an African man, is the face of an African man. And what the trial has opened up, interestingly, is a space for talking about the ways in which gender violence crosses racial and ethnic lines. But it has also brought up the question of, you might say, the ways in which violence against women gets authorized by particular narratives having to do with, in Oscar's case, what are my patriarchal rights as a property-owning South African male to protect myself and my property? In the African context of communities that are more impoverished, still those issues of masculinity are very much at the forefront. And in addition to issues of rape in heterosexual contexts, is a strong culture of what is called corrective rape, whereby women who have been identified or targeted as lesbian are also the subjects or the victims of sexual attack and corrective rape. And again, also, however, within this context of discussion about violence against, you might say, sexual minorities in South Africa, also violence against women across the board, but at the same time, also a revival of a practice that's called ukutwala. And what ukutwala in traditional culture was part of a set of marriage rites. And there were complicated cultural situations under which a young girl might be kidnapped from her village and told that you are going to marry so-and-so. Now, there's a lot of, you know, debate and back and forth about the origins of this cultural practice. But anthropologists and others who have studied it agree that it was never, ever done with children and adult men, which is what the practice has devolved into now. And that largely, again, because it was a cultural practice of perhaps two families or groups of people trying to negotiate a relationship, there was always room for refusal on the part of the young woman in question. What is happening now is that very young girls are being coerced into marriages with people that they do not want to be married to. And what is at stake in South Africa now is ukutwala is being defined as a cultural practice. And so if ukutwala is to be outlawed or banned, there is the question of, are my rights to practice my traditional culture, which are protected in the Constitution, are they being threatened? So we can see the ways in which, when we talk about religion and public life and the ways in which these things crash together, that in that crucible of sexuality, all of these things coming together. What is also interesting about what is happening in South Africa is South Africa is not alone in the rising rates of gender-based forms of violence, in particular sexual violence. In Uganda, I think in February, homosexuality was declared illegal. I think quite recently, similar laws are being debated and are they're about to have the trigger pulled on them in Senegal, in parts of Nigeria. So, and also in many of these places, this phenomena of corrective rape also takes place and are also areas where culture and traditional culture are often deployed as not simply sexism, but rather, I do not want Western values and ideals being imposed upon me, trying to force me to change who and what I am. So this becomes important because I do feel like these areas have become, you know, particularly an interesting point for South Africa, a point at which they can either take an important leadership role on the continent, or, you know, the way in which South Africa responds has the potential to be extremely important. So South Africa, interestingly, has been called upon, or there is there within the UN has been called upon to take a leadership role on these issues, with the idea that it will seem less like Western culture being imposed from outside, and that it is indeed at least an African initiative to speak out and against these issues. The other issue, of course, is the way in which the targeting of people who have been identified as gay and lesbian becomes a way in which to undermine their own rights that are protected by a series of global rules of governance, like, for example, the international protocols that protect people's human rights. So many of these laws that are being passed are actually in direct conflict with other protocols that these nations have signed. And what we're finding, less in the case in South Africa, but certainly in Uganda, is that they are being used sexuality as a way to get around people's constitutional rights. So I do feel it's a thin edge of a wedge to be able to essentially ignore your own constitutional principles. So for example, in Nigeria, where this law is being debated, the Constitution explicitly says that you cannot discriminate against people. However, the ways in which culture is being used, it's being used to undermine. So similarly, in South Africa has signed every protocol. South Africa was recognized gay marriage before the United States of America. But nevertheless, the ineffectual nature with which these crimes are being dealt with, again, consistently undermines the Constitution and then suggests its overall weakness. So I see, again, these issues as, you know, really, of course, obviously speaking to the core issue of sexuality, but also very much about, you know, how in South Africa and other places are we going to mediate this relationship between tradition, which was very much under attack during the entire time of colonial rule. In fact, our culture was why we were told that we were subject to colonialism, enslavement, and so forth. So the desire to protect and uphold culture, and at the same time, the desire in which to recognize and protect, particularly the lives of women. So again, you know, another really important moment that happened just before I got there on spring break was that the Council of Traditional Leaders, you know, was at the Constitutional Court as they debated which would take precedence, the Constitution or the clause in the Constitution that protects people's right to express themselves and practice their religion and culture. And a very strong rural women's movement developed in South Africa, which argued that if you were to have this clause, if the Council of Traditional Leaders were to be able to be given this power, all of us would essentially be subject to traditional law, that we would not be protected by the rights of the South African Constitution. And the Constitutional Court ultimately, finally, in a long fought out battle, decided that the Constitutional Court and everything else could override the Council of Traditional Leaders. But it doesn't mean by any sense that it's over. It's a powerful lobbying group within South African politics. And again, it shows, and that the issue, you know, again, that they were talking about and debating was this issue of ukutwala. And very many of the issues that have to do with people's rights to have freedom of speech and freedom of expression, as women in particular, because much of this traditional law targets women, versus their right as South African citizens. So are my rights as a South African citizen going to be undermined by, you know, my belongingness to a particular culture as a female? So when I think about, you know, the you know, sort of what to, how do I feel about what's happening in South Africa? I feel that we are, again, at a really, really pivotal moment, given that you have an entire generation of young people who, you know, grew up and they, apartheid was not, in terms of legal apartheid, a significant part of their lives. And we have a large generation of young people who are, while they very much, you know, revere the legacy of the person who Mandela was, what we didn't see on the newscast was the extent to which the current president was regularly being booed at the public forum that he appeared, you know, to honor Mandela. He was at a major football stadium, the memorial service where the infamous selfie was being taken, was taken. Actually, he was booed repeatedly at that service. And so there is, and you know, he is the representative of the ANC at this time. So there's really an important moment of a group of young people, while they are not going over to other political parties, are very, very disaffected by the current state of South African politics. And the extent to which they are loyal because of that simple legacy is definitely something that is in question. And also the extent to which they are becoming, you might say, rapidly dissatisfied with the business of usual as the business of usual politics, and what kind of spaces that they are creating in South Africa in order to try to challenge that. So I do think, and again, the groups that are organizing around gender are having a really, really important role there. But the recognition by the ANC elite of those groups and those pockets of dissension is simply, it's really not there. So again, I think at this point of 20 years and beyond, I think when we look back in history, you know, we will see this year that this time that Mandela passed as an extremely important time, not simply because of his passing, but I do think, you know, sociologists, we don't like to make predictions because we're usually wrong. However, I do think history will show that this next decade is going to be, yet again, one of those really pivotal decades. Like 1985 was a pivotal decade and a pivotal moment in the anti-apartheid struggle. And I think we're going to look back at this particular period of time, and it's going to be absolutely world-changing for not only South Africa's internal relationships, but South Africa's relationship to other entities on the continent. Is that about 20 minutes?
Terrific. That's perfect. Thank you. Thank you. I know we've got tons of questions, and you've put a lot of really terrific insights on the table. So let's just open up the floor for questions.
Yes. So when I was in South Africa, I did go to Cape Town too, actually. When I was in South Africa, I had a number of conversations with young women about things like bride price and things like, which seems to me to be purchasing a woman in some ways, and the dominance of men in the household, sort of as a cultural norm. And I just sort of wonder if you could speak to those issues.
Sure. I mean, that's like a very interesting thing. So South Africa has this tradition called lobola. And when you think about, well, where and why did this come from? And the missionaries sort of disparaged it as the practice of, quote unquote, buying wives, which it actually was not. So you consider a community in South Africa, traditionally marriage, unlike marriage as we imagine it in the West, the marriage was never about the bringing together of two people. Marriage in South Africa was always about the brokering of relationships between two families. And the fact, lobola was, how was this bride wealth paid? It was paid in cattle. And the idea being that we are brokering a relationship between these two communities. And this is an exchange of, you might say, good faith. And at the same time, it is an exchange to make sure you will not only take care of the person from our community that's going to your community, but this relationship will remain, you might say, sacrosanct, but renegotiable. So it became this symbol. When you say, I want my lobola back, she wants to go, the relationships have broken down, and so on and so forth. So then it was not, the missionaries called it buying wives because, and that's entirely another lecture. But essentially, again, gender became an interesting wedge through which colonial relationships could be established. So the idea was that the missionaries were going there to convert these heathens who, amongst their heathenistic practices, was this business of buying wives. So we must westernize them, impose a different set of rules, and that gender politics was right there. So it was always this thing about negotiation. So even another practice, like if your husband died, you would be married off to his brother. Not because people were kinky and strange, but again, so the relationship could, between these two communities, and the notion that simply because the immediate link has broken down does not mean all the things that we agreed can be reversed. So that was the idea why you would marry your brother-in-law. What is it today? Well, today, I mean, again, especially given South Africa's class politics, it's largely upper class, the black elite, that is now very, very strongly engaged in this practice. And it was never meant that I bring my laptop and my bank details, and you bring your laptop and your bank details, and we exchange Mercedes. And much like you can think about why did people have weddings and dowries in a farm community in the United States versus I'm going to go register a Crate and Barrel. Those are not the same things, although the modern day manifestation, when it gets married to, you know, commodification and capitalism, becomes very different. So again, that's what we have here. But we also have a discourse, even operating on, you might say, liberated young women, when they face patriarchal relationships in their marriages, being told, I laboloed you and you have to do what I say. So it is not a small thing, and it is something that, you know, younger women are, you know, increasingly facing, because South Africa is very, very traditional across all races. There is a strong social pressure to be married and to be married earlier. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those things women do push up against, and then you're told that you went to school and you became Western, and that's, you know, I mean, my nieces face that. I have three nieces, and they're, one's 25 and the other two in their 30s, and they're not married, and they're pretty much considered old maids by South African standards. And the common thing says is, well, their mother went to America and she raised them with all these funny ideas. And that's why, you know, they act like that.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Oh, okay. The first thing I thought about hearing this, which I found really fascinating, is that, you know, we're used to thinking of anti-colonialism as the desire to be free. And constitutions, which colonial powers think are the major good part of their legacy, are there to enshrine freedom. But what this sounds like to me is part of a boomerang effect or a reactivity effect that's occurring years later after the generation that, you know, fought for and achieved independence, where the level of comfort among some people with the guarantees that constitutions are designed to protect is just not there. So what you're really getting is a kind of repudiation of it. It looks more like a continuation of the idea that colonial powers know best, and they determined that we should all have these so-called rights, but we're not that comfortable exercising the rights or having other people exercise them. And I'm wondering if you feel like constitutionality itself might be in danger, or is this just a rear guard action on the part of traditional authorities that eventually will die away?
Well, it says one of those things that the actually constitutionality both provides this, is supposed to protect against it, but provides the space. So when South Africa, when they were negotiating the constitution, you know, it didn't happen overnight. It was a 2-year process of going back and forth with different lobbies and all sorts of brokerage politics and so on and so forth. However, you know, and the Council of Traditional Leaders was an important interest group, both in delivering votes to the ANC. So while we think about the Rainbow Nation, it just seems like an unproblematic all black people vote for the ANC, we forget that in Natal, there was another center of power, the Inkatha Freedom Party, which was an ethnic-based power. My ethnic group, the Zulu, though I never, you know, clearly was never an IFP person, but there was a particular ethnic politics at play there. And to deliver that constituency in particular, you know, you had to make concessions with traditional leaders. At the same time as well, there was a strong recognition that many, many things that people held sacred were, you were told they were wrong all the time. Like, for example, you know, it was an act of heresy just for my parents never to baptize me or give me an English name. right? So all my sisters have some English name. My parents both had English names. I was the only one. Like, my parents had become so radical at that point, they were like, forget about it. This is her name. This is it. No baptism, no English name, no nothing. But you were told everything was wrong with every single thing that you did. From animal sacrifice, to how you named your children, to your religious practices, all of those things you were told not only were wrong, they were actually outlawed. So in reversing the wrongs of apartheid, constitutionally, it was very important to protect people's rights to practice their own traditional culture, even the protection of gays and lesbians. Because the apartheid regime, we tend to think of this sexual violence as new with the post-apartheid era. Actually, it was not at all. I mean, people who were coerced and made, you know, white soldiers who were conscripted, you know, they were regularly harassed, called homosexuals, beaten up. Being a homosexual and being a communist kind of went together. And there were both things that you could be just accused of being, and all manner of rights would be stripped from you. So it's not accidental that South Africa was one of the first places to recognize people's rights to sexual autonomy. I mean, we were the country that gave you the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act. So it was strongly recognized that people's right to express themselves sexually was an important right that needed to be protected. But at the same time, you protected the rights of traditional religious. You protected people's rights for free speech and assembly. You protected their rights to form their own schools if they wanted. And so some people are saying, well, we reserve the right to discriminate against the people that we don't want to have around us. And, you know, in oftentimes very, very, not just discriminate, but very, very brutal ways, right? And you also have a legal system that can barely go after any of the crime. And then rape, I mean, we all know everywhere in the world, notoriously underreported, difficult to prosecute, and so on and so forth. So that crime in particular, the legal means that should be there to protect you, whether it's a corrective rape or a regular rape, the police system is way too strained. Like, rape is massively under-prosecuted.
We had a couple of questions. Yeah, Bethel.
Have you looked at the parallel between Middle East cultures and that have such things as bride price brokering of relationships between families, and when the brother dies, you marry the brother. Have you looked at that?
No, I mean, I have not.
Because there is a parallel there. And
strong.
People riding through villages and stealing. I mean, yeah. There's a lot, and I'm curious to know if this is just the human condition that caused this to happen, if there are any anthropologists here. Or, I mean, I know I'm not going to start naming cultures in the Middle East. You all know their names. And I particularly am from the Armenian tradition. And I know this happened in the villages in Turkey, in Western Armenia. And so it was so familiar and interesting to hear you talking about it. And also surprising to hear you being so surprised. What's your name?
Sandra.
Being so surprised that families were male-centered. I mean, families have been male-centered.
No. And I wasn't surprised at that.
The dominance of the men.
These were highly educated women.
Oh, okay.
The apparent inability of even them to kind of
the highly educated
do anything
okay.
about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any comment, or should we move on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, these things exist because human beings have to survive in remarkably similar ways. So, I mean, again, where does this whole tradition of giving people things when they get married, even in the United States? Like, because if you're on a farm and you're a young couple starting out, people have to pitch in and help you. How that got to I'm registering at Crate and Barrel, you know, so we can ask ourselves a similar set of questions, right? Like, in all cultures, people do things that are harmful to themselves. Why do women in America get breast implants that are supposed to be so progressive, right? So in all cultures, we find ourselves doing and enacting things that are oftentimes in opposition to our interests, and we embrace them in as our culture, or we just like it, or I just want to look a certain way. So, you know, obviously, everyone else's culture is always abhorrent to someone else looking at that culture.
I'm saying it's very similar. What
yeah.
I'm talking about is very familiar.
Yeah, Alan?
No, Claire, I think.
Claire first. Okay, yeah.
First of all, I want to applaud your pointing to these issues being the current challenge, not only for South Africa, yeah. but for the world in a way, because what we're talking about is evidenced in so many places. Mm. and what I'm going to say may be totally off, I don't know, but the voices of dissent around the ending of apartheid were very strong, very personal. Mandela, Tutu, you know, they emerged as bigger than life figures, and they mobilized people to action. Are there figures like that in this current issue about dissent emerging into acceptance, do you know, as apartheid was? Because I'm not familiar with them, and I just like to know there are people who can mobilize action in the way that these guys did. or whether even that's begun to change, if the process of change has altered in the post-Mandela and Tutu, because I don't know how strong he is anymore either. But, like, has that whole scene changed? People have, you know, the enormous personal power.
I do think it has changed. And I also think, like, the terrains of struggle do call for a different type of leadership. So, in fact, even people were talking about, okay, even though there were those big guys, who was doing all the organizing and mobilizing the community that didn't end up in parliament? It was largely like, you know, women played a huge role. Like, if you look at, for example, the townships in the Cape, around Cape Town, you know, the United Democratic Front, you know, it was women that held that movement together, very much so, and mobilized. And mobilized around such unglamorous types of things as, like, bake sales and kindergartens. They call them creches there. And, you know, the actual business, day-to-day business of the movement, they held it together. So you look at people who are mobilizing around gender-based forms of violence, for example, things that are happening at the household level. It doesn't actually lend itself so much, both the communities and the type of organizing, to the emergence of a charismatic, you know, leader of this nature. Mm-hmm. And the sort of, you might say, relationship between leader and polity that is suggested by that big charismatic is precisely what they're actually trying to undermine and undo. So I don't actually think there will be someone emerging like that. But it makes it harder. I mean, you could really fundraise for this guy. Like,
yeah.
The other thing is that when, forgive me for taking one more question. I mean, asking one more question. Mandela Tutu, that whole time of the anti-apartheid movement was a movement against a tyranny. And here, there's dissent about around internal, deeply embedded values and behaviors, which we all have.
Exactly.
We all have. And that's a way, way different scene.
Completely.
Way different scene.
Completely, exactly. So the enemy was clearly defined.
Yeah.
And everybody, I mean, nobody likes putting people in jail and so forth, but many people say, but I don't support homosexuality, or, well, I do believe in the sanctity of marriage, and all of these things. It's a very, very different set of issues to mobilize around.
Right.
Yeah, Alan.
I'm going to ask an extremely parochial and self-interested question, so I hope you'll
forgive
me. So I've just finished a book on the Jewish diaspora, and South Africa plays an enormously important role in that story with people like Richard Goldstone or Albie Sachs or Helen Sussman and so on. So because of apartheid, I mean, these turned out to be generally very human rights oriented, very liberal Jewish intellectuals and activists. And I just wonder if there's any legacy of that human rights emphasis that Albie Sachs or Goldstone stood for.
Absolutely. I mean, those are exactly the principles that are being used to argue against these type of retrograde, you might say, actions. So, I mean, the legacy lives very, very strongly. There's no question. But again, the set of issues that they're dealing with are not so Manichaean that a broad human rights discourse is an easy way to talk about them or get in, right? Mm-hmm. So although, and in fact, some people, well, it's my human right to practice my culture. It is my human right to fill in all of the blanks. So although it's still there, it's a different set of, the issues engage with it in a different type of way.
Teresa.
Yeah, I recently read Susan Muller Oykin's Is Multiculturalism Bad for Women? And her thesis is kind of that group rights are intrinsically bad for women because of the protection of cultural practices. Mm-hmm. And of course it's been criticized as like overly Western and such. But I was just wondering, given all of your discussion about all of the harms to women that are currently occurring, do you see a way for multiculturalism and group rights to be protected while women's rights are equally protected?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's got to be. So, I think also you also have to look at the ways in which these, it becomes a cover for doing other kinds of things. So, for example, okay, you can point to the example of Uganda, right? It is not actually simply people that are self-identified out gay activists. If you do anything the government doesn't like, they'll call you a homosexual and attack you. And much like a communist, and it's not only being gay, it's associating with gays, promoting being gay. You know, all of the things that were said about communism. So it becomes simply this way of tarring someone and a way to remove them who is uncomfortable for you politically. So I do feel that, I mean, again, the first way is, I don't know, you know, a way of engaging. And I mean, you don't have to be a communist to agree that all communists should have their basic human rights protected. And so I do feel that there's a way in which we've got to get back to this notion of, even though you recognize and want to celebrate your culture, in some ways, you've got to give that if first of all, if indeed your culture means oppressing women, you can, and also a deeper interrogation of culture. Because many of these practices, that's the thing, even traditional law was codified and written as traditional law under colonialism. Traditional law was a living, breathing thing. It switched and changed depending upon circumstance. It was never rigid and static. And within, so people have also pointed out, within the context of traditional law, however, there was, even in Zulu culture, a space for homosexual activity. In fact, in many African cultures, it was actually the privileged class. In other words, it set you apart as special. There was no barrier to leadership by being gay. Or engage in, I suppose that's a bit modern, a spin to put on it, but to engage in acts that we would today label as being homosexual. So I do think a deep interrogation of actually what is culture and where do these ideas about culture would go a long way, because many of these things are very modern impositions on a set of very flexible cultural practices.
Jonas, you had a question.
Could you say a little bit more about why the younger people are disaffected with the ANC, whether it's policies or they're being ineffective, and you know, what are some of the details?
Oh, sure. There's a whole bag. Unemployment is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, unemployment is at 30% or something. School leavers, that's what they, you know, people who have a high school education who passed matric, hideous levels of unemployment. The matric pass rate, so I suppose, unlike our SAT, more like the English system. You take this test, either you get a university entrance or you get what's called a school leavers, which means you don't earn a university entrance, and then simply passing it. The pass rate is dismal. So the state of education is really, I mean, the ANC poured a lot of money into education, but still to bridge that gap, people are very dissatisfied, both with the education that they're getting. And even once you get, even leaving university, your ability to get a job. So people are very, very dissatisfied with those policies. And they're very dissatisfied with the levels of inequality. Because there actually is a very wealthy class of people in South Africa, a multiracial class of very, very wealthy people. And for, you know, many of the, and again, the people that were people who have the most chance of being wealthy, you know, are lucky ducks like me whose parents left. Like, I could go back to South Africa and get a terrific salary and enjoy all sorts of privileges. But, you know, somebody who decided to run away and become a gorilla at age 16, you know, doesn't have the same positioning to be able to take advantage of all of these benefits of freedom. And so, you know, there is definitely a hereditary upper class, both black and white, in South Africa. And people are highly dissatisfied with the fact that they feel like a certain group of people got to embrace all the gains of freedom, but you wouldn't have gotten there without all of us. And where is our piece as this group gets, you know, I mean, anyone who's been in South Africa has seen that it's a very, very luxurious place, depending upon what neighborhood that you happen to be in.
Yeah. And it sounds like a failed education system kind of locks that system into place.
Yes, and nobody wants to go into teaching because it's very poorly compensated. And, you know, you think we have problems with classroom size. I mean, rural schools and so on and so forth. you know, people do not want to go into it. There's no money and there's not, I mean, for the government to actually be able to bridge that gap, they would have to do a tremendous amount of dispossession of resources to make the education system even approach equitable.
We have lots of questions. Wilco and then, was it John? Paul, sorry. And then over here.
Sure. South Africa's in an election year, as you may or may not know. And last month, Mompele Rampele was announced a partnership with the DA, with the Democratic Alliance, to run for president. It didn't end up working out, collapsed about a week later, unfortunately. But it, from what I understand from my classwork there, that it seems like the ANC is pretty much a shoo-in for this year. From what I also understand is that it is very divided on race, so the ANC is still very black and the DA is still very white. Looking ahead to 2019, which is when the next election will be coming up, do you see a change in the political landscape at all, in the DA getting more influence, because the ANC really dominates the political landscape in South Africa? And I know the Western Cape, which where Cape Town is still very, it is Democratic Alliance. There's a strong power there, but really not in the rest of the country. So I was wondering if you could comment on whether we're going to see any changes, especially after Nelson Mandela's passing. I think the ANC really has a leg up here, and says he passed and he was our great leader, and I think that's a very strong campaign to run on, because a lot of people still have very strong sentiments towards him. So maybe 5 years out, do you see this changing at all?
Yeah, the problem is, I mean, people are disaffected, but the only groups that keep popping up are groups that are to the right of the ANC. And the only really way you're going to challenge them is to go way left of the ANC, which puts you in hot water with the rest of the global economy. So all of these new groups, like, people are not going to go to the DA because they're sick of the ANC, because the DA is even worse in terms of their politics on equality. The DA is they're even anti-affirmative action. I mean, very few people who are the South African mass, so South African's ANC is largely black because the mass of the country is black and the poor mass is black. The DA and all of those groups have nothing to offer to poor people. And so the ANC doesn't have nearly enough, but they've got more than these. And the election platforms that they're putting forward, if they were to put forward platforms that would appeal to that mass, the DA as it exists, all those people would bolt from the DA. So the only party that is going to be able to win a significant number has got to be significantly more progressive. But then, how are you going to bring those policies to a neoliberal global world? I mean, you're not even going to be able to enact them if you're elected on them.
Speaking of economics, what back here?
Yeah. So I was going to ask a non-economic question.
Oh, all right. You're welcome to do that as well.
I think of the youth ANC and, you know, kind of really giving it to the ANC and so on. But I was just curious in terms of sexual orientation, gender issues, and equality, is it a case where the youth is what we would expect in our mind, that the youth are really pushing for more freedoms, or is there any sense that the youth are also pushing for more cultural power, if you will? And is it kind of, who is it that's really pushing for this? Is it, I think going back to this question earlier, is it really like an older group on its way out, kind of, they were there before under apartheid, they've gotten freedom, they're pushing back, it's kind of a pushback phase, and then it'll be gone, the traditionalists.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, do you see the young as rejecting tradition and going up for themselves? Or are they coming back to tradition?
I feel like they're in some ways, a disaffected youth, especially men, it can be a place to come back to. So, for example, if you look in the townships, where only really poor people live, and who is engaging in these acts of corrective rape, it is young guys. And where is the last refuge of a disaffected person? I mean, patriarchy is free. So, you know, it can be, and especially even talking to young people and talking to my nieces, that again, when the rest of the world seems so slippery and you seem to be losing on every turn, it becomes a very easy place in order to enact some degree of power. So I wouldn't say just because someone was young was making them progressive. And I would definitely say amongst a certain group of disaffected young men, patriarchal politics, and across race, because young Afrikaner men definitely, I mean, English-speaking men have always been more of the upper class in South Africa, but there's more, definitely more of a working class and poor Afrikaner population. And even amongst them, a strong push towards traditionalism, even speaking in Afrikaans and so on and so forth, because it is something to hold on to as some vector of power in a world that you see that feels like any other vectors of power you had have just slipped through your fingers.
Dick, right?
Could you talk a little bit about Mbeki's views on HIV and how they developed and how it's moved beyond that since Zuma has been in power? And will it change with the coming election?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of those... I mean, Mbeki prided himself on being a very forward-thinking guy. He had the whole ideas about the African Renaissance and so on and so forth. And this is one of those times when a desire to speak up against the way every part of your culture has been degraded by the West comes smack dab and smacks into, you might say, a current political situation. So the reason that he engaged in all that AIDS denialism, he was trying to... He was making this point about, you know, why is it suddenly, you know, at the point at which it's Africa century, you know, the whole thing, that all of a sudden we are the face of AIDS today. You know, that is what everybody is speaking about. South Africa is the AIDS capital of the world and so on and so forth. And there was a very racist discourse that accompanied discussions about AIDS, like can be discussions about crime and any other social ill. You don't simply say, I'm not going to deal with crime or the other social ill because of the way in which it has come wrapped in a very racist discourse. I think he could have spoken of the ways in which AIDS and discussion about AIDS was mobilized in very racist ways and still, and also spoken about the real push on the part of the drug companies to get a foothold in South Africa, which he was also, as a person who was who could be at times critical of the way in which global capital worked. I think there's a way he could have discussed those things without launching into full-blown AIDS denialism, which is where he went. And with Zuma, it got even worse, because Zuma actually, I mean, when you talk about why is he being booed, well, there's no nice way to put it, he raped daughter of a childhood friend who wasn't a lesbian woman, HIV positive, and he said that he protected himself against getting HIV by taking a shower. So, I mean, that is, you know, that is what the young people are...
All in 27 minutes.
Yes, are booing, right? So he is certainly not the face of progressivism. And in fact, one of the ways in which he distinguished himself with Mbeki was, again, speaking a bit more about, you know, here's this guy, went to Sussex with his pipe... You know, that was all fine and well, but I'm going to return us to being more, you know, first of all, like the Zulus are going to get their chance. The Xhosas have always been in power and the elite, but also a notion of a more populist that, you know, I can connect with you on that more populist type of level. He's removed. He spent half of his time in Russia and going to Sussex and getting economics degrees. That whole African Renaissance, that's great, you know, but that's all very academic. He appealed on that more populist type of politics. So
I'm of the future, though. What is that going to hold?
After him?
Yes.
That'll be an interesting one. I mean, we've had a couple of characters come up in the ANC, like Julius Malema. And the thing is that these people tend to bubble up, and they're thick as thieves, and then they fall out in these spectacular ways. So, I mean, it's all been men, though. So there have been, you know, there's a lot of jockeying for position within the party. And so there are people who have denounced Zuma very, very, you know, strongly. But, you know, for example, like this guy Malema, who was supposed to be the voice of the youth, the voice of progressivism, and, you know, spoke out in these strong, you know, was tight with Zuma and then broke with him. You know, it later comes out that that guy's lining his pockets just as much as, and that, you know, politics becomes that space of brokering like any other place, and a place to line your own pocket and enrich yourself. So within that ANC infighting, I'm not entirely sure, you know, there've got to be, because when you talk about like the ANC branches in the communities are different from the ANC in parliament. So one would hope that at least on the community level, where those branches do a lot of things, they work on education, you know, they're often like the face of service delivery on the ground. But those people are often not, you know, elevated into those elite spaces that are, so one would hope that's really the only hope of the ANC, if one of those people is not only able to get in there, but then is also able to keep like a moral head about them and not be seduced by, you know, the fact that it is a very, very, very powerful party. Like, you know, as much as we'd like to not talk about ourselves as being a one-party state, and there is a strong respect for the notion of democratic process. Everybody knows that, you know, affiliation with the ANC is a powerful affiliation. So, for example, when I was working in South Africa, before I went to University of Hawaii and came here, and I was, like, having all these problems with my department chair, and someone said to me, well, your father's big in the ANC, why don't you just, like, threaten him with that? And I was just like, what? But, you know, in even, like, you see people's pictures on Instagram, and somebody will be, like, next to a porch, and they'll have, like, an ANC flag, and they'll be like, thanks, ANC. So with, you know, the, what you might say, they're called tenders. I don't know what word you'd use it for. Like, say I wanted to put in a bunch of condom machines in every BC bathroom, and I need to get a contract to do that, right? How do I get the contract? If I'm close to people in the ANC, I know people in the ANC. You know, when you talk about young people, you know, that is a strong method of upward mobility for you know, young people who are well-positioned. And so those types of benefits that you can get as a result of your closeness to centers of power, you know, it would be very naive to say that that is not a problem and that is not something that any aspirant in the ANC will have to face about what type of position. So, I mean, in a way, he was lucky. Like, he was, there's no place to remain more moral than in a prison for, you know, close to 3 decades and then 5 years of being president. Like, he was as clean as a whistle, you know, and a lot of these type of politics had not entered the party. But now, the ANC and that landscape is a very, very different place. I mean, you would have to be an extremely principled and moral person to be able to resist those temptations.
Was Eric, did you have your hand up before?
No.
Eve, yeah.
I'm reminded, I don't know if you were in the department then, Jackie Alexander's talk in our speaker
No,
series.
I wasn't.
Okay, so she was a Caribbean sociologist, and she argued that indigenous leaders stand at the confluence of 3 forces. 1, they are really trying to do something good for their own society. 2, they're trying to line their own pockets. And 3, they're representing their society in global forums, political and economic. And so she was talking about how differences in the ratio of those forces play out. And corruption became sort of the default option. If you couldn't be effective, if you couldn't move forward, that strengthened, you know, the impulse to say, well, if I can't, you know, get a good terms from the WTO and I can't advance my agenda in the UN and I can't get credit and I can't build roads and I can't build schools, I can get the Swiss bank account. And that became kind of a default option. And I'm wondering, not so much that particular assertion, but that notion of elites being at the confluence of those 3 forces of building up their own community, representing their community to multinational forces, and lining their own pockets, if that has resonance for you in terms of the ANC.
It definitely has resonance. And, you know, maybe unlike some of the states that are such failed states that your only option is corruption, I mean, they're still actually managing to build roads and build schools and, you know, do things of that nature. But, I mean, South Africa is a very, very wealthy nation on the continent. You can live a stupendous life if you have money. And it is stupendously tempting to want to live a stupendous life. And so they are able actually to do some degree of service delivery and be effective politicians while at the same time very much living the high life.
Porsches
and
for the people.
Hmm?
Porsches for the people.
Well, no, Porsches for them, and, well, you know, there's more electrification than there was before, and there's more. So, again, their position of power on the continent, you know, the fact that it's actually not going to probably be allowed to collapse into disarray because of the strategic importance of it to every place else in the world, the large white population, right? It is a very easy place to live. You go to South Africa, you feel like you are in Chestnut Hill if you are at a certain class level. And there's a certain, you know, redistribution of wealth to keep the wolves at bay type of thing, right? So it is not the notion they're like, not necessarily growth through poverty alleviation, which is where they started. But a notion that you have to do some poverty alleviation and these sort of nice gestures to, you know, broadening the middle class. But you're going to have to need a much more profound economic transformation to deal with those levels of poverty. And right now that is just not pressing for anyone in the elite at this moment.
Well, this has been so terrific. I know there's more that we can maybe talk to after, but we need to let people get back to class and such. But thank you all for being here. It's been a terrific conversation. And thank you especially
to... Thank you, guys.